This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. Today there's a new definition of close in American politics. The presidential election is still unsettled. Republican George W. Bush is expected to hold on to his tiny lead in the state of Florida, which would push him over the top in the Electoral College. At the same time, it looks as if Democrat Al Gore will hold on to a rare but meaningless trophy of his own. He will probably lose the White House, but win the popular vote. The Republicans retain control of both houses of Congress, but their already narrow majorities there will be even narrower. In a contest where, as it turned out, everything mattered, political operatives on both sides are agonizing today over squandered opportunities and miscalculations. Joining us now is Dana Milbank, who covered this campaign for the New Republic and later the Washington Post. He's at his home in Washington, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, Neil.
That had to be the longest and perhaps the strangest night in American political history.
Right, and I feel like the night's not over. It looks like we could be going on like this for another couple of days. This campaign sort of began in earnest 2 years ago, and we're no closer to knowing the answer now than we were all the way back then.
Two candidates running for the political center, and they apparently found it.
Yes, they both did. Now, the difference in the race right now is that the right wing of the Republican Party sort of towed the line, and the left wing of the Democratic Party didn't. I actually chose last night to watch the returns over at the Nader celebration here in Washington. The idea is not that he would be celebrating a victory, but that he had the real potential to throw the election from Gore to Bush. And as the way it's stacking up right now, if indeed Gore does lose in the electoral vote, it can be put quite squarely on Nader's shoulders. You can see the numbers in the various states clearly would have made for a different outcome if he weren't part of the race.
Yet, if you're right in identifying the Green Party as the left wing of the Democratic Party, there was almost a double failure. They didn't elect Al Gore, and at the same time, they didn't get their 5% that they need to get financed for the next election.
Right. It looks like they've come up with about 3% of the vote, so they will not get the federal funding next time around. So as a party-building exercise, it wasn't terribly successful. Also, the exit polls indicate that the Nader didn't reach many of the goals that they had in terms of having more young people vote, bringing more non-voters into the process. It looks from the returns as if there were no more first-time Nader voters than there were first-time voters for everybody else. And he was only sort of had a marginally larger share of the young vote than he did of the overall vote. So in terms of as a party-building exercise, it failed. The only thing it may have done is, he can take credit as the spoiler. And I tell you the truth, he made at least three, quote-unquote concession speeches last night, each one sort of trumpeting that, they're going to have to listen to us now. But it seemed to me that he was sort of reveling in the idea that, the eyes would be on him for throwing this race.
What was the reaction of Nader supporters last night as the results came in?
Well, it started out with the idea of cheering for whatever they could find. Nader getting, was it going to get, 7% in Vermont or 5% in New Hampshire, without a bit of concern for what the overall picture was. The target was getting his 5% to get the federal funding. I noticed as the night went on, though, that, people were drifting away from whatever campaign official was talking on the stage and watching CNN on the televisions in the room there. And, when Gore got California and other states, there was a cheer going up for him. I asked people about that, and they said, well, all things being equal, we'd like to have Gore win. I saw some guy, making a private aside to another Naderite that, we're going to be blamed for all this. He insisted he was just joking and it's not fair, and of course we shouldn't be blamed for it. But I think they know darn well that they will be blamed for this. And, it's simply a matter of the numbers. And they say, well, if Gore was a better candidate, then then it wouldn't have mattered what Nader did. And you know, on the other hand, had a Nader or his type existed in the 1960 election, we never would have had a President Kennedy. So that to me is probably a tough argument for them to make. So the public face, and certainly I think Nader is delighted at the idea of being able to sink Gore. I mean, he came, he came out three different times last night. These were not concession speeches. I think some of his followers are going to feel a bit more ambivalence about that, that they did not succeed in getting their, establishing their party as a, as for federal funding, but they did apparently succeed in getting a Republican elected who's going to be a lot more hostile to their causes.
My guest is Dana Milbank of The Washington Post. Al Gore may have been charismatically challenged as a candidate, but he did have some options that he didn't really use, and that was, the guy most people regard as probably the best political campaigner ever, Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Right. He didn't use him, but, you could also argue that had he used him more, he might have lost very significantly. Clinton did go stumping in his home state of Arkansas, and he could not deliver that for Gore. And if he could not deliver his home state, you've got to wonder, how many, independent voters in the Midwestern battleground states he would have offended. I don't think, assuming Gore has lost this election, which we don't know for sure, this is the time when all the recriminations begin, and they'll wonder about, should they have spent money here, should they have spent money there, should Gore have taken a different tone, and inevitably the question of what should they have unshackled Clinton. But, the truth, the evidence shows that every time they did unshackle Clinton, he went out there and started talking about himself and saying, vote for Gore. He's the next best thing.
Yeah, it was almost four more years.
And that was not helpful to the vice president. And, it was apparent to the Gore people and I think to most of America that his larger interest was his wife's victory in New York. I think Gore rightly believed that his interests were not necessarily the same as Clinton's. And probably the other bit of the recriminations game will be that Gore certainly, while not running using Clinton out there, certainly could have run much more strongly on the Clinton economy. It was almost like he didn't want to talk about the past at all, but the past 8 years were not exactly something that he had to hide from.
In the final calculation, though, if Gore had managed to win his home state and President Clinton's, Florida would not be the center of the universe today.
Yes, that's conceivable. Much has been made of the idea, of particularly of Tennessee, that my goodness, the guy couldn't carry his home state. But if probably everybody has, looked at the red and blue taking up the screens on the television, there's just such a solid South, with the exception of Florida, which isn't really part of the South anymore. But this is very solid South for the Republican Party. And if you look in Tennessee, they've got a pair of Republican senators, a Republican governor, and it is just very solidly a Republican state. And Gore came to power there in a different time, and so it's not particularly
surprising.
And with
the benefit of his father's name as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Democrats were still strong there in the 70s and the 80s when he was serving, but. It's not particularly surprising that a Democrat is not winning in those states. I suppose it's a little embarrassing for Gore that he couldn't pull off his home state, but I'm sure that's not the biggest worry on his mind today.
Are there people, do you suspect, in both camps who are wondering, if they had just made that extra buy at the television station in Orlando, or the extra campaign stop for a Hadassah Lieberman in Naples, would this have made the difference?
you know, you got to be second guessing and all that, but I can't imagine what else these folks could have done. You know, you mentioned Orlando. The television market there was so flooded with ads that they actually shut them down. They would not accept any more ads. They just reached such utter saturation point. So I've got to believe that in terms of television marketing, you know, there was such overkill. You know, it was like some absurd, you know, counting of nuclear arms. It was just, it's hard to imagine anybody's message particularly got through over the muddle. And then in terms of visiting there, I mean, they've just been darting back and forth there. You know, and even on election day, I think Gore finished it, you know, in the wee hours of the morning in Tampa. And, you know, Bush certainly spent an awful lot of time, and his brother in the end did a good bit of work for him. So you never know. I mean, I think what I'm sure if, you know, the 2% of the people who voted for Nader had to do it over again, they would have decided differently, and there may be a whole lot of folks there who would have come out to vote had they had any idea this would happen.
My guest is Dana Milbank of The Washington Post. We'll be back in a few moments. This is Fresh Air. Dana Milbank of The Washington Post is on the line with us from his home in Washington, D.C. You did a piece of economic analysis about the effect of television advertising, and the fact was that the people who are experts in this business realized that they had to spend, A, a lot more money, and B, run, I think it was quadruple the number of ads to have the same effect as ads had 4 years ago to get their message across.
You know, I think that the effect is, it's almost like this is the sort of self-limiting idea of the campaign, is you get so many ads done, you know, people get bludgeoned so much with the stuff, I can't imagine they don't just tune the whole thing out. You know, it's, you know, I sat down in Lansing, Michigan one night a week or two ago just to watch. There's, you know, something like 200 ads I saw, you know, during the primetime shows. And then, you know, in some newscasts, you can get 60 or more in an hour. You know, how can this possibly be, you know, forming coherent opinions in people's minds? So I'm not sure this is necessarily a bad thing. It may wind up just removing ads as a weapon in these things, simply because people are just bludgeoned with them too much.
It's interesting, though, to get that advertising time. The campaigns, for the most part, don't buy time on national television, on the networks. They buy local time.
Right, and that's a complete change. Before 1992, it was basically all network stuff. And then it was sort of Clinton, beginning of 92, and particularly 96, who sort of figured this out and said, hey, you know, we can spend a lot less money and just put it where it really matters. You know, if you put it on the network news, you're preaching to the converted in the Northeast if you're a Democrat, and, you know, out in the Mountain West in the South if you're a Republican. Why not just, you know, put it where it counts? And that's why they're, you know, just bombarding, you know, local markets in Philadelphia and, you know, Lansing and Grand Rapids and Detroit, you know, down in Orlando and other parts of Florida. I mean, even in, you know, states like Montana, you know, you just couldn't buy an ad. It was just all booked up. And then out in Seattle and Portland, whereas markets like Chicago, Los Angeles, there was... you know, it was quite easy to get an ad on there because there wasn't much being contested.
For a couple of elections in a row now, we've read and heard about the new and critical role that the Internet was going to play in American politics. Was this an election of cyber significance?
You know, Neil, I started out covering this 2 years ago, and I was people had come to me and wanted me to, you know, put together a book on the campaign, which I agreed to do. And I started out saying this was going to be a book about the effect of the Internet. And needless to say, that is no longer the subject of the book, because you went through, just over time, it became clear that while those techniques were interesting, they were so much at the margin, it just really wasn't making a difference in the race. And the first sign of this was Steve Forbes. He went great guns with his internet work and all the database and, you know, all sorts of technological things that would be very hard for most of us to understand, and, you know, predicted how they could really take apart George Bush, who was running this traditional sort of industrial model campaign. And we all know what happened to President Forbes. So, you know, and basically what it came down to in the presidential race was sort of the dueling websites, you know, where you could go for information. It doesn't seem that the internet was useful as a tool of persuasion, you know, of bringing voters into the process or of changing their minds on things. Where it was useful is just in the communications aspect between, you know, coordinating your volunteers, you know, keeping your staff coordinated, and so technology was very useful as for sort of the logistics of the campaign. Both parties, the DNC and the RNC, used technology extensively in their get out the vote efforts in terms of you know, sort of profiling voters and figuring out, you know, where the best place to do their hunting for voters would be. So they, you know, used it a bit for targeting. But you know, they did ask in the exit polls last night how many people you know, use the internet regularly, and I think it was something like 2/3 of voters, and how many get their political news from there, and that was a reasonable number as well. But there's little indication that this new medium has come anywhere near the old media in as a tool in campaigning. But that, you know, I'm sure it's just a matter of time till it happened. It's just, this is not the year.
That incident that happened in Maine, 24 years ago, the November surprise, as it were, you think it had any effect?
This public, the polls indicate, obviously just shrugged off the whole idea of a quarter-century-old drunk driving arrest. The thing that was dangerous was that the appearance that Bush had tried to conceal this and, you know, was being generally slippery about it, and that, you know, brings up comparisons to the much larger offenses of President Clinton. And the problem for Bush was the whole idea of his campaign was about, you know, a fresh start, and we're going to, you know, return honesty and decency to the White House. And I did an article just sort of stacking up Bush's responses when this drunk driving thing came out with Clinton's responses to the Lewinsky scandal, and they were almost word for word the same thing. Like, this is the work of my political opponents, and just sort of, you know, turning the issue away from themselves, saying they did it, you know, they were quiet about it to protect their families, that sort of thing. So that, to me at least, was a potential for damage. But I can't imagine that sort of nuance filtered out to a large portion of the electorate in the last 72 hours. Gore was closing in the final days of people who made up their minds in the last 3 days. A significant portion of them went with Gore. So it's, you know, that could be caused by any number of things, you know, sort of, you know, taking the safer course or that sort of thing.
History tells us that if the country is prosperous and at peace, people will vote for the status quo. In a way, I guess they did. The Republicans will hold on to very small majorities in both houses of Congress. Obviously, if George Bush is the next president of the United States, he will get in there without a sweeping landslide-type mandate. Doesn't look like a lot of things are going to be able to be changed easily in Washington.
Yes, that's true. I don't, you know, I guess I disagree with the way you describe it a little bit, and I think that, you know, sort of history and historic models would have predicted, yes, support for the status quo, but specifically support for the incumbent administration. And all these models we've always been hearing about, and just say it's just a matter of the pocketbook and the economy, and if the economy is growing by X percent, the stock market is going in this direction, well, the incumbent party wins quite easily. And these models had Gore winning anything from, like, you know, 3% of the vote up to, you know, by 3% of the vote all the way up to, I don't know, 12% or something like that. And, you know, it's time to start redrawing the models here. I mean, this, you know, even if Gore somehow, you know, pulls this out, the models were dead wrong. And this suggests that that something has changed, I think, in the way, you know, Americans are viewing economic success, and presumably, since the expansion has been so long, many of them are taking it for granted because of the the impeachment issue dominating recent years, certain issues of values and honesty and integrity may have taken a front seat to the traditional economic issues. But this this whole election has been a, you know, really, history's really taken it in the chin this time around. You know, all the models that have been used, you know, is this going to be like 1960? Is it going to be like 1980, like 1988, or, you know, a host of elections going well back into the 19th century? You know, they're all conflicting, and nothing really worked out as a model for this.
Dana Milbank of The Washington Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, back with Dana Milbank of The Washington Post, who completed 2 years of campaign coverage at Ralph Nader's headquarters last night. We were talking about historical models, and I guess there are a lot of them to the Tilden Hayes election of 1876, and maybe it was because I was up all night watching TV, but I don't remember that one quite so clearly. The one freshest in people's minds, I guess, is 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon race, and that time the disputed returns were in the state of Illinois. Richard Nixon famously decided not to challenge them. John Kennedy was sworn into office, and Nixon always believed that that election was stolen from him.
Right, and you know, I mean, that in that sense, I mean, that 1960 is, you know, not the right comparison for many reasons. You know, the economic situation is different. The you know, the candidates are quite different.
There was a Cold War then, too.
There were some many other things going on in the world, but you know, but the similarity in the sense that, you know, this time when we're looking at Florida, I mean, there's a real possibility that this thing's going to be decided by a bunch of lawyers in the courts. You know, are people going to be, you know, arguing over whether Gore voters accidentally punched the ballot for Buchanan because of the way the thing was set up?
Something had to explain those Buchanan votes.
One would think so. Not that he got that many to begin with, but yes, it certainly wasn't in the counties where one would have expected Buchanan votes to come out of. You know, it will probably leave us with a sort of unsatisfied opinion, and both sides can gripe about it for, you know, a long time to come. But but we don't have to, you know, wonder about, you know, recounts, because they're happening automatically in this case. And you know, I think as Americans, we can agree that as the democracy that we are, the election should be decided by lawyers.
One other outcome of that 1960 race, though, was that Richard Nixon never felt that he'd been rejected by the American people. He hung around in American politics and later got elected president. Had some other problems later, but that's outside of what we're talking about right now. Al Gore, if he does lose this race, can certainly feel that he was not rejected by the American people. We've had a series of elections where if you lose the presidential election, the feeling you've been dismissed by the American people. Is that going to hold this time, you think?
Well, you know, who knows? But I would have to imagine that that's, you know, this is, if Gore loses here, as appears likely, that's it for him. The whole idea was, you know, given the circumstances, you know, in the good times in our country now, this election was his to lose, and he, if this, you know, bears out, winds up losing it, then I don't, you know, I think he joins the happy ranks of Dukakis and Mondale and will, you know, not be welcomed back into the ranks of candidates again. You know, there's been griping about Gore as a candidate throughout this race, and a lot of that's legitimate. He was a less than inspiring candidate, and you know, there was a lot of thinking that a more charismatic candidate could have had a field day with an inexperienced opponent like Bush. So I think that this is, you know, this whatever the outcome, this is, you know, this is it for Gore. You know, if he loses here, he's not going to get another crack. It's unclear what he would do.
Maybe go back into journalism.
he might go back and become an investigative journalist at the Nashville Tennessean.
How did you handle it last night? Obviously, things were up in the air. Did you end up writing three different stories?
Well, yeah. I mean, all through we had extended at the Post our deadlines significantly through the night, and even then, obviously, the final deadlines because we still don't know the results have did not have the results. Writing about Nader, I was trying to tiptoe around the issue. You know, the question is, would he get his 5%, and would he be a spoiler for Gore? Now it seemed, you know, and I was filed the last version of that just before 1 a.m. And it was becoming pretty clear that he wasn't going to get his 5%, but the spoiler was anybody's guess at that point. So, the larger issue I focused on there was that they didn't really care if they were the spoilers or not, and they were saying how they don't care if they're blamed for it. It's not their fault. It's Gore's fault. But, it's a traditional in journalism all over the place to have your backup be matter for the story, which is just sort of the boilerplate information, and then plug in the numbers as they come along. But last night was not a scenario anybody was planning for. I'm due to be heading off on vacation to out of the country tomorrow night, and it never occurred to me that I wouldn't know who won the election before I leave.
Dana Milbank, thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Dana Milbank writes for The Washington Post.